This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, economist Rick Wolf talks about Greece and its impact on the rest of the world.
Greece is a tremendous cauldron now for social change and really a weather vane on how things might go in the rest of Europe and even the United States.
Chris Hedges joins us to talk about the recently signed National Defense Authorization Act.
And his lawsuit against Obama for daring to codify what's been the practice of the United States government to say it can pick up anyone, including a U.S. citizen, and put them away.
We'll talk with a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers about the recent Trader Joe's victory and their upcoming campaign against the supermarket giant Publix.
A year ago, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers were demonstrating against Trader Joe's here in New York City. They won a victory against them, and they're launching another campaign March 5th in Lakeland, Florida, the headquarters of a large supermarket chain there called Publix.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The huge and sustained fight back against massive austerity cuts continues in Greece. In that small southern European country of 11 million people, half of whom live in Athens, there's been a wave of general strikes going back to August of last year. Not only are the economic powers that be, particularly in Germany, forcing terrible cutbacks on the standard of living of the Greek people, they're also hollowing out democracy in that country, the country, after all, which was the birthplace of democracy. Despite their efforts, the left in Greece has grown enormously and now rivals in size the combination of the right-wing parties. What's happening in Greece is going to have a ripple effect on other European countries, particularly Portugal, Italy, Spain, Ireland, and Hungary. Today we welcome back to Law and Disorder Professor Richard Wolf to speak about both the economic situation and the political situation in the country of Greece.
Rick Wolf, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Now, we're looking at a situation in Europe in which five countries have downgraded. We're going to see, I guess, half of Europe facing a recession, essentially. We wanted to talk about that as well as looking with a microscope at what's happening politically in Greece and how that may impact the rest of the world.
Greece is important more than ever for several reasons. Perhaps the best way to contextualize it is to remember something from the long tragic history of capitalism. There was a time early in the history of capitalism when the policies in places like Britain, France, Germany, was to take people who had gotten themselves into debt and couldn't pay, and to punish them by sticking them into a poorhouse where they were badly fed, badly housed, and obviously, because it was a prison, they couldn't possibly earn any money, which meant that their opportunity to repay a loan that they had been thrown into prison for was actually being deteriorated by being imprisoned. Eventually, the morons who did this realized that while they didn't mind the cruelty inflicted on these people, the cruelty inflicted on their families, who were guiltless, the cruelty inflicted on their local communities and relatives and friends, that didn't bother them. But what really bothered them was their discovery that if you put people in jail for debts, they stop buying anything and stop earning any money, and you, the business, have nobody to sell to. This realization eventually led to the elimination of poorhouses and the elimination of imprisonment for debt. You might have thought this lesson had been learned, but it hasn't. In Europe, we now see rich countries and the rich in each country working really hard to punish the debtors, not to ask what the conditions were that got them into debt, not to admit that for the years that these people were in debt, they paid off handsomely to the creditors in high interest rates that have led them to make a boodle of money. Nor is there any examination of the conditions under which this happened so that there's nothing being done to change those conditions. Instead of all of that, which would be a rational way to look at this, we are instead engaged in a vicious punishment of a debtor country, a small country. Let's remember, Greece has got 11 million people. To be excited about the economy of Greece as a danger to Europe would make exactly as much sense as if I spent a lot of time on this program examining the difficult conditions in eastern Rhode Island. You'd all think I was nuts, and you'd be right. The only reason to focus on Greece in this way is because it's being made an example. It's an attempt to terrorize the rest of Europe that's in all kinds of debt for all kinds of reasons into not thinking about resisting, not thinking about stopping payment, because if you dare, then you will go the way of Greece. And so Greece is being literally, tragically, and I use the word tragically with all the implications of ancient Greece and the tragedies, basically being tortured in this situation. Let me continue briefly as follows, because the problems of Greece are really the problems of many countries in Europe. Those that are closest to Greece right now in trouble are the following: Portugal, Spain, Ireland, Italy, Hungary, and others. But those are in the most severe kind of problem, looking exactly at Greece for what is wanted. How did the Greeks get into this situation, and how did it come that the Germans are doing so well and the Greeks so badly? When unification of Europe happened over the last 40 years, and let's remember why it happened, the Europeans as a people had gone through two of the worst wars the human race has ever experienced, fought overwhelmingly on European soil, fought overwhelmingly among European countries. Two mass slaughters of people, of wealth, of economic life, World Wars I and II, led the Europeans afterwards to say, we must overcome whatever the conditions are that bring us to kill one another on such a scale. Try to imagine the United States as having had two civil wars within a few years, what the meaning of that would have been to our society. So they embarked on a program after World War II, after the end of that war in 1945, to bring about a unity which was finally achieved in the 1990s. It took them a long time, but they finally got a unity. And as they knew, and as they discussed this unity, they knew that in order for a unified Europe to be a source of peace and prosperity, which was the point, they'd have to balance out the rich and the poor. And it was expected that that would happen, that those who were richest would have to share a little bit with those who weren't. And who were the poor ones coming into the European Union? Greece and Portugal and Spain, it's the same story. And later Eastern Europe, too, after the Soviet system collapsed. None of that was done. In fact, under the unified Europe, the equalizing process never really happened. First of all, the Germans, and this is crucial, but also the French and the Dutch, they were terrified of unity. They wanted the big market that all of Europe together would provide, but they were afraid that businessmen would move production from the high-wage parts of Europe, Germany, Scandinavia, Northeastern Europe, and so on, Northwestern Europe, to the poorer places where wages were lower, Greece and Portugal and Spain and Italy, and that this would be the equilibration process that would bring unity. Industry would move all over Europe, and particularly to the poorer areas who needed industry to come. This looked good for the poor countries. They came in for the unity to get that. It didn't look so good for the businesses in the north, so they went to work in the typical capitalist way. Imagine a meeting in a German industrial office. The industrialists sit down, they call in the trade unions, and they say, look, we now have a unified Europe. Your wages are twice what they are in Greece or Spain or Portugal or Italy, so we're leaving. We're going to close the factory here in Dortmund, and we're going to move it to outside of Milano or outside of Madrid or outside of Athens, because we can get very skilled workers with a good education system and used to working, and they work at a much lower wage. And the union of workers in Germany goes, oh my God, we're going to lose our jobs. Well, you don't have to, says the industrialist. Here's the deal. We keep your wages right where they are. Not only that, we kind of work things out to have a growth in productivity, but we'll get you another job. We'll make it work here. We'll make it so attractive here that the industries won't leave Germany, France, and move south. At least not in the way that we had feared. If we move anywhere, it won't be to the rest of Europe. It'll be to a place where the wages are still cheaper than all of that, namely China. So what you had was a bunch of industries staying in Germany and the wealthy countries. If it moved, it didn't move to southern Europe. It moved to Asia to take advantage of cheaper workers, leaving the southern Europeans with no way to become better off in this unified Europe, whereas the Germans and the others were making a bundle of money. So that inequalities inside Europe got worse, not better, in this process, which is why country after country, if you poll the mass of people, are very dubious about European unification. For them, it hasn't been anything like what was promised. And the extreme example is Greece. They lost out. They had to pay high prices that are now European prices. They're stuck with the currency of all of Europe. They are buying more and more German products, which they can barely afford, as their own industries disintegrate. This would have been a problem already 5-10 years ago. The reason it wasn't, and this is so important, is that the Germans wanted to make money off of the rest of Europe. For them, the unification meant everybody is a customer. So what did they do? German success, German industry, German wealthy people took the profits they earned and lent them to the Greeks to continue to enable the Greeks and the other southern Europeans to keep buying. This should be a familiar story to Americans. It's like what happened in the last 30 years in this country when wages stopped going up and the money made by corporations who didn't have to pay rising wages was in turn lent to the workers to keep the system going. We now know what the end result of that story always is. In 2007, the American economy collapsed because you can't lend any more money to these people. They can't pay the debts they already have. We learned at first that the right wing likes to blame the poor. In 2008 and 2009, the story from the right in America was those terrible poor people who should never have borrowed that money, they're deadbeats, they don't pay. Forgotten was, you've told Americans what the American dream is. You've told them they ought to live it. They ought to give it to their children. You made the only way to do that, once you stopped paying higher wages, borrowing money, which banks came in and pushed on people en masse because it was profitable. And now, when you've pushed that game beyond its tolerability, you want to blame the poor people as if they alone made it happen. The Germans fueled the debt disaster of southern Europe. It could not have happened without them. To blame then only the borrower and to exonerate yourself as the lender is to not see the entire disaster. The Germans, together with everybody else, have made a disaster out of this unification. It is a failure of capitalism to solve its problems. A unified Europe that worked could have happened, but it would have required planning. It would have required a way to equalize the conditions of all the people, to give them all a shared stake in unification. They didn't do that. They stuck it to the mass of poor people on the edges of Europe, and those people are now saying, in a profound way that we may want to talk about, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to tolerate having the problems of this failed experiment taken out on the poorest people in the European Union.
Yes, indeed, Rick Wolf, we do want to talk about that. I just read an article by a Greek school teacher who said that he has to drive 80 miles to the schoolroom where he teaches. There's no heat in that classroom. 20% of all the teachers have already been laid off. The children don't have enough to eat. He had to go to four different stores because the first three were boarded up right. in order to buy a magazine. Most of his salary goes for petrol just to drive to work. He says, my situation is typical of the crunch that's been foisted upon us. Just the conditions of everyday life in Greece, where half the population of the country lives in Athens, the conditions of everyday life are abysmal, and people are fighting back in a wave of general strikes and mass protests that's really quite extraordinary. And I wanted to ask you if you would put that into the political context. What are they saying? What are they doing? Who's the leadership? What do they want?
Well, I think the important thing at the beginning of this is to recognize that the Greek people are in a combination of shock. This is not anything that they were told a capitalist economic system would deliver to them. This is not capitalism delivering the goods. This is capitalism delivering a disaster to the majority of people. And you can blame them all they want, but in the end, when all the dust clears, an economic system that is supposed to be embraced by everybody cannot succeed if it is driving the mass of people into living conditions of the sort you've just described. Under the new settlement that was agreed to last week by Parliament, the minimum wage is being reduced by 22% starting next week. I mean, a society, and it wasn't high to begin with in that country, but a society that solves an economic problem that is continent-wide, all over Europe, by sticking it to the minimum wage people, that's a society that's out of control. But I don't want to leave the impression that it's just a population that's in shock. It's also a population that is coming out of that shock and is very, very angry. That's why you have so many general strikes. That's why you had fires in the middle of Athens over the weekend as people were angry. But politically, here's what's happening. The current government is a government of the major, what used to be the major parties in Greece. It is a coalition government that has three components. Number one, PASOK, that's the old socialist party of Greece that used to be in government, won the last national election, and formed the government. Papandreou, the leader of that government, resigned a couple of months ago, having made a fiasco out of the following. He had run and won in the last election. He won in a big way by saying he would never impose an austerity on Greece. He then turned around, said that the previous government had underestimated the debts of the country, which it had, and that therefore he was going to do what he had run on the platform of not doing. The Socialist Party was getting a roughly 40% of support in the government back in 2009 and early 2010 when they just were coming into power. The latest poll taken over the last weekend by Public Opinion, it's the major polling agency inside Greece, gives popular support for the PASOK party in the current polling of 8%, dropping from 40% to 8%. It's important to understand a socialist party that imposed austerity on the mass of the people has now gotten the people's response. 8% of us support you. The second component of the current government is an extreme right-wing party, small, built on an anti-immigration program, as happens in much of Europe. It's called the LAOS, I don't know how it's pronounced, party. In the polling over the weekend, it polled 5%. And the third party is the New Democracy Party. That's sort of the Greek equivalent of our Republican Party. It's the major center-right political party. They get roughly 30%. But you put those numbers together, and the coalition gets 40, 42, 43%. That's what it gets. Who else is there? Three leftist parties. And let's see how they're doing. All of these parties are either new or tiny. Up until now, first, the Communist Party of Greece, 12.5%. That means they get as much public support in public opinion polls as the extreme right and the Socialist Party together. Number two, a far-left alliance of non-communist but socialist and radical parties, Syriza it's called, got 12%. And third, something called the Democratic Left Party, a moderate left party, picked up 18%. Well, do the math. You put together the Communist Party, the Far Left Alliance, and this left of center party, the majority of Greeks have spoken. All those parties are out of the government, and all those parties support an end to austerity, a reversal of austerity. So it is now possible to say that after a year and a half, 2 years, almost 2 years of a pretty vicious austerity policy, what has been achieved is that a majority of the Greek people have made it crystal clear that they've changed their political allegiances and they are now supporting a clearly left anti-austerity opposition. It is very hard, therefore, to see how much further they can go, and the Europeans are now in the process of imposing more austerity than we already have. It's hard to imagine that you are not moving towards a fundamental civil conflict, and we shouldn't even shy away from the term civil war, because the Greeks are angry. You can see where their anger is going. The confrontations between angry people and the police are getting worse by the day. The government owes the debt. The people will not let the politicians pay the debt, and that puts an impossible. So you must help us, because if you don't, here comes the game, always played by a debtor against a creditor. You push me far enough, and I'll declare bankruptcy, and you won't get anything. And not only will that hurt you, but it will say to all the others that are in the same situation I'm in, here's the solution. That's why the Europeans said, okay, don't do that. We will lend you. Now, who's the we? The European Union, that's the combination of the countries, together with the European Central Bank, that's the equivalent in Europe of what the Federal Reserve is here. So imagine the federal government together with the Federal Reserve, which is a little bit different. And the third party is an international lending agency called the IMF. That's called the Troika in Europe. They negotiate with the Greek government. Next to them is something else. Is a committee of private lenders, because this is the Troika is the governmental agencies that came in and gave a lot of money to the Greeks. What did the Greeks do? They used the money that Europe gave them to pay off the private creditors so that they could get their credit okay, meanwhile substituting the European money for the private money. But there's still lots of private creditors out there whose debts haven't come due. So the Greek government is negotiating simultaneously with the European governments to get help that way and trying to stave off the private people from having to declare a bankruptcy relative to them. All of that is going on as they desperately try to hold on. The private creditors want to save what they've lent. The Europeans want to save what they've lent. But the bigger issue is, in every European country, there's a tremendous tension between the rich, the government, the banks, and the mass of people. And what's happening is, cleverly, in France, in Germany, the governments are changing their people's understanding, not seeing the struggle inside each country as to who pays for this crisis, who pays for all the government debts that every government has accumulated to deal with the crisis, the mass of people or the rich. And they're going to change that in each country by making the workers in each country be angry at Greece, be angry at the Greek worker, see the problem as other countries' difficulties rather than recognizing the fundamental issue, which is inside Germany, inside France, inside Holland, inside Sweden, who's going to pay for the crisis capitalism produced and for the governments that borrowed money to bail those capitalists out of the crisis? And they don't want to pay for the bailout they got. They want everyone else to do that. And the flashpoint for that is Greece.
We are speaking with Professor Rick Wolf, a Marxist economics professor here in New York City. Rick, let's pretend that you're actually in Greece, and we're going to change your name. We're going to put an Akis at the end of it.
Yes.
And you're in one of
Anopolis.
Rick Wolfopoulos,
right.
And you're in Athens, and you're in one of the three leftist parties that make up the aggregate of 43% of the population in Greece. And my question is this. You're at a meeting of the party. They say, Rick, what do you think we should do next? What should we be for in Greece, and what should we tell our comrades in the other European countries like Portugal or Spain? What should we tell them in our sister parties over there? What should they be doing?
Well, I'm afraid the answer is as simple as it is dramatic. It is a system that doesn't work for the majority of people. And when a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, if I can borrow from American history, when in the course of human events it becomes a ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, the answer is you got to change the system. The way to solve this problem is, first of all, to stop allowing the decisions over government finance, over private finance, over debt, to be made by a small handful of very large corporations working out deals that are beneficial to them at everybody else's expense. So workers taking over the enterprises is number one. Number two, there ought to be a nationalization of wealth in the society so it can be redistributed in ways that make the society fair and equitable. If there are problems of the society economically, they should be gone through together with everybody bearing a reasonable share of the burden of all of this, not anymore that wealthy people can escape all of the effects of what's going on so that it's left for the mass of the poor. You got to do the old traditional socialist idea, however dangerous socialism has sometimes proved itself to be in the way that it's developed. I'm not making light of those problems. Socialism has its problems too, and those have to be worried about. But we have a capitalism that is becoming rapidly intolerable for tens of millions of people, and we have to recognize that not making a dramatic break is plunging people into an even greater degree of risk. This is a society in fundamental shift. And it's, again, it's very traditional. It's like going back to the 1930s when, to take one example, in Iowa. Who thinks of Iowa as a place of radical rebellion? Well, let me tell you. In Iowa in the 1930s, there were farmers who had taken out credits as part of the boom of the 1920s, encouraged by banks who lent to them and made a lot of money. And then when the bottom fell out of the American economy, through no fault of these farmers, they couldn't sell their farm produce, they couldn't earn a living, they couldn't pay back their debts. And they went to the banks and explained that, and the bankers, of course, knew it. And the bankers said, tough, we're not going to take a loss, so we're going to take your farm. We're going to foreclose your farm, throw you off the farm. And the farmer said, but that's crazy. Because if you throw me off the farm, nobody will farm. There'll be no food. You're a banker. You can't do it. You're going to sit on empty land. Yeah, but we have to recoup the mentality of the lender, like we see. So they began throwing farmers off. And in order to get that done, the banker had to go into court and go through a foreclosure procedure. And a judge had to declare, yes, the property is now foreclosed. The bank can take it. At a certain point, so many farmers were being destroyed that they set up something called the Iowa Farmers Militia. And they issued a decree. And the decree said the next judge who authorizes a foreclosure, we're going to kill him. And they did, repeatedly. And Roosevelt had to mobilize the army and the National Guard to protect the judges, and there were pitched battles between. So the idea that this is unique to Greece, this is a rerun of an old movie, and it never ends well. One of the things that happened in the Great Depression was Roosevelt and his advisors understood that even if they could hold on in Iowa, what other states were going to go in that direction? Who else was going to take that? They were so terrified that one of the reasons we had Social Security created and unemployment created and a federal jobs program created, none of which is done in Greece yet. One of the reasons that happened in the depth of the Depression was the mass opposition. So there is some hope that as this situation polarizes through the strengths of the Greeks to fight back, like the farmers in Iowa, you can begin to see some big changes, and they'll come fast.
We hope there will be massive changes indeed.
Rick Wolf, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The National Defense Authorization Act was signed by President Obama on December 31st of last year and takes effect this coming March. The act authorizes the military to begin domestic policing. The military can detain indefinitely without trial any U.S. citizen deemed to be a terrorist or an accessory to terrorism. Vague language in the bill, such as substantially supported or directly supported or associated forces, is used. We're joined today by returning guest Chris Hedges in his capacity as a plaintiff in a lawsuit that he's just filed against President Barack Obama with respect to the National Defense Authorization Act and its language about rounding up even American citizens and salting them away forever.
Chris, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Can you talk about the significance of codifying the NDAA into law, essentially several overreaching practices that the executive has been implementing for a while now?
That's correct, but it has been implementing those practices through a radical interpretation of the 2001 law, the Authorization to Use Military Force Act. Remember old John Hughes, you know, was Bush's legal advisor. It was under the auspices of this act that Jose Padilla, who is a U.S. citizen, was held for 3.5 years in a military brig. Remember, he was supposedly one of the other hijackers who never made it to a plane, stripped of due process. It's under that old act that the executive branch, Barack Obama, permits himself to serve as judge, jury, and executioner and order the assassination of a U.S. citizen, the Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki.
2 weeks later, his 16-year-old son.
Yes, exactly. So, but what this does is essentially it codifies this kind of behavior into law. It overturns over 200 years of legal precedent so that the military is allowed to engage in domestic policing. There are a couple very disturbing aspects in the creation of this legislation. One of them is that Dianne Feinstein had proposed that U.S. citizens be exempt from this piece of legislation, and both the Obama White House and the Democratic Party rejected that. Now, Obama issued a signing statement saying that this will not be used against American citizens, but the fact is legally it can be used against American citizens. There was an opportunity for them to protect American citizens and protect due process, and they chose not to do that.
Well, he also announced that he was going to close Guantanamo.
Right. I mean, it's very disingenuous.
And signing statements really carry no legal force.
Right. And if they had wanted to protect basic civil liberties, they certainly had a chance to do so, and it was their decision not to do that. I mean, the other thing that's disturbing is that it expands this endless war on terror. So the 2001 Act is targeted towards groups that are either affiliated or part of al-Qaeda involved in 9/11. Now it's groups that didn't even exist in 2001. There are all sorts of nebulous terms like associated forces, substantially supported. When you look at the criteria by which Americans can be investigated by our security and surveillance state, it's amorphous and frightening. I mean, people who have lost fingers on a hand, people who hoard more than 7 days' worth of food in their house, people who have waterproof ammunition. I mean, I always say that, you know, I come from rural parts of Maine. That's probably most of my family. it's a very short step to adding the obstructionist tactics of the Occupy movement.
Well, that's what we wanted to ask you, because we've thought all along with the beginning of this war on terrorism that ultimately these laws stripping us of our constitutional rights would be used against the social protest movements at home. And the latest development is absolutely chilling, and we wanted to ask you about that.
We don't know what the motives are. We do know that all of the intelligence agencies, as well as the Pentagon, oppose this legislation. Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, actually went before Congress and said that if it was passed, it would make the FBI's work in terms of investigating terrorism harder, because it would make it harder to get people to cooperate once you hand the military this kind of power. So I think it's interesting, to say the least, that the very agencies that are being pulled into domestic policing, I mean, especially the Pentagon, didn't push for the bill. And, you know, I don't know what the motives are, but I know what the consequences are. And that is that it hands to the corporate state weapons the capacity to use the armed forces internally in ways that we have not seen for over two centuries. That is the consequence of the bill. What are the motives? You know, I haven't gone down and reported it in Washington.
Chris, you know, I'm thinking of the Supreme Court case Humanitarian Law Project and the notion of providing material support. And in that case, it was also very vague, and things that seemed benign could be construed as providing support. But it strikes me that under this piece of legislation, also the notion of associating with others that the government may deem terrorists becomes possibly vague.
Well, it is vague, and that's what's so frightening. And the lawsuit was proposed by civil rights attorneys Carl Mayer and Bruce Afron, who approached me and said that they needed a credible plaintiff. Now, because I had been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, and I was in the Middle East for 7 years, I spent considerable time with both individuals and organizations that are considered by the U.S. State Department to be either terrorist or terrorist groups. That would include Hamas, Islamic Jihad in Gaza, the Kurdistan Workers Party, or the PKK, as it's known, in southeastern Turkey, northern Iraq. All of these organizations, I mean, I used to go to Tunis and to have dinner with Yasser Arafat and Abu Jihad when they were branded as international terrorists. And there are no exemptions in this piece of legislation for journalists. So I think they felt that I was a credible plaintiff because of that. We have already seen, under the 2001 laws, a persecution of not only Muslim Americans in this country, but Muslim American organizations, in particular charity organizations, and most specifically charity organizations that support the Palestinians. And under this legislation, it is certainly conceivable that not only these, many of these organizations have been shut down, their bank accounts have been frozen, their organizers have been persecuted, but under this legislation, they're essentially able to be branded as terrorists, stripped of due process, thrown into a military brig, and held, in the language of the legislation, until the end of hostilities, whenever that is.
And are you worried about a retroactive component?
Well, that's interesting. I don't know that there's been any talk that I've seen, like you're talking about the FISA Reform Act was retroactive.
Right.
In my position, I'm the last person they come get. I mean, you know, if we look to what's happening to Muslim Americans in this country and the assault against their civil liberties, it sets a kind of precedent within the legal system. So as a New York Times correspondent, I have a certain standing. That doesn't mean I'm not on the list, but I'm usually not ticked off first. I think it's a lot like the drug wars, where you allow the state to come in, they do drug testing, arbitrary drug testing, and then suddenly it's drug testing for people who want jobs, it's drug testing for people who want to apply for welfare. I mean, it expands outwards. Once you establish that legal precedence, once you strip us of any kind of legal defense from this kind of activity, then inevitably it spills out into the wider society. So it of course will first be used against Muslim Americans and Muslim groups in this country, and because of the demonization of Muslims across the political spectrum, a lot of people will turn away and assume that's what they get. But you know, the history of rising totalitarianism shows that that is a very foolish thing to do. So I'm trying to be proactive. I'm trying to fight it while we still can fight it. The reason we filed in the Southern District Court is because they have a fairly good record, at least in some of the judges, in sort of at least being open to issues of civil liberties and violations of constitutional rights. And if they're now determining which judge has it, but the lawyers are speaking about pushing the litigation so that they can at least get some kind of an injunction to stop the law, which is supposed to take effect in March, to at least challenge it and hold it in abeyance while it's questioned legally within the judicial system.
Our friend Jules Lobel, who's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, took over after Michael Ratner left. Jules and Michael brought a number of lawsuits like this in the 80s against America's wars in Central America. And Jules concluded his experience by writing a book called Success Without Victory. And I think this is the same kind of thing, because you're able, aren't you, Chris, to bring some publicity to this latest civil liberties atrocity. And my question is, what kind of news rippling have you been able to get from filing this lawsuit?
Well, it's interesting that the corporate media has pretty much ignored it. This runs across the political spectrum. Nobody wants this bill. I think the polling is between 2 and 9% of the American public supports this bill. The very agencies that are tasked with internal security and defense opposed it. And I think it's a pretty clear case of violation of basic constitutional rights. Given the composition of the Supreme Court, I'm not particularly hopeful, if we get there, that we'll make it. But I think it's incumbent upon all of us who care about fighting back against this destruction of what's sort of left of our anemic democracy that we at least try. And this is, of course, why the Center for Constitutional Rights and people like Michael Ratner are organizations that I have tremendous amounts of respect for. Remember, I was in Central America in the 1980s. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. I covered the Contra War in Nicaragua. And what would have happened to those of us who were traveling with armed units from the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front rebel movement in El Salvador, or with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, which we frequently did, if this legislation had been in place? I don't think there's any question that, especially given the composition of the Reagan administration, with these kinds of tools, and Elliot Abrams, of all people, in charge of the State Department's policy on Central America, that we would have been branded as terrorists.
Exactly. Well, what happens now, and how can our listeners help out in this effort?
Well, a lot of people have asked, can we make this a class action lawsuit? We're not asking for money. We're just asking for the law to be overturned. I think Bruce and Carl feel that, I'm a peculiar and strong plaintiff, given my history. There probably aren't a large number of Americans that have that kind of intimate contact in an official capacity. I was a reporter, of course, with terrorist organizations and terrorist groups. So I don't think they're looking for other plaintiffs. They're not going to turn it into a class action suit. Nobody needs to send us any money. They're doing this pro bono. We're not asking for money from the government. We're just trying to challenge the law. I think that if it gets up there, if it gets to the Supreme Court, then I would hope that concerned citizens would go to Washington and demonstrate. If our voices are not going to be heard within the halls of justice, then they should be heard right outside the halls of justice.
Well, we can do the same thing here in New York City. If it gets a hearing down at Foley Square, we'll be there.
Yes. Chris, I wanted to remind listeners that among your many, I believe, 9 books that you've published, one was Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, and also War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. We so appreciate having you on. Are you working on any books right now?
I just finished doing a book with the graphic artist Joe Sacco.
Great.
Oh.
We spent 2 years on it. It's called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And it's written out of the poorest sacrifice zones of the country, Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, usually every year the most dangerous, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, where there's a average life expectancy for a male of 48, the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti, the coal fields of southern West Virginia, where the majestic Appalachian Mountains are being blasted into a moonscape and all the water and air and soil poisoned because of mountaintop removal. And then finally, the agricultural fields in Immokalee in Florida, where it's the perfect worker is created by the corporate state, and you often have conditions, working conditions, that replicate slavery. Mm. And it's to say, look, this is what happens when you kneel before the marketplace. And these places were first, and you're next. When we gave the book its name, there was no revolt. The idea of revolt was conjecture. And then suddenly on September 17th, Zuccotti Park appeared. And so we put the last chapter, we added Zuccotti as the last chapter. And it's all drawn. There's 50 pages of drawing and comic panels, as well as 70,000 words of text, heavily reported. You know, writers and artists are never happy with their work, except the only thing I can say, if we have killed ourselves on this book. I don't think we could have worked any harder. We care so much about it. It's been a total labor of love for us. We're completely broke, of course.
When is it available to the public?
I'm copy editing it now. Joe is finishing the last drawings, and it will be out in June.
Name of it again?
Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt.
We can't wait to see it.
I think by using the comic book form, you've got a real shot at reaching the young generation who we want to go to. And I wish you every success with your lawsuit, Chris, with your book. We'll do everything we can to publicize both. And we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, Chris.
Bye.
Earlier this month, Trader Joe's and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the CIW, announced the signing of an agreement to formalize the ways in which Trader Joe's will work with the CIW and Florida tomato growers to support the CIW's Fair Food Program. The efforts to push the farm worker living standards above slave labor is gathering momentum in Florida. Now efforts are turning to the large chain Publix supermarkets. The $28 billion supermarket giant has refused to pay a single penny more to help end farm worker poverty. To talk about the focus on Publix, we get an update from Jake Ratner and CIW member Elbin Perez.
Jake Ratner, welcome. Elbin's a comrade with the Immokalee workers, and he's also going to help us with translating. Elbin, congratulations, hearty congratulations on your victory at Trader Joe's. We remember a year ago when you guys were demonstrating against Trader Joe's here in New York City, and now you've got them to sign the Fair Food Contract. Tell us how you did it and what the victory means to you.
Bueno, para nosotros es muy importante la victoria de Trader Joe's. Realmente no solo nosotros como comunidad de Immokalee, sino que tenemos el apoyo de...
And so one of the main tactics we use is obviously protest. And we were planning an enormous action for the day that Trader Joe's opened their first Florida store, just about 30 miles from Immokalee in Naples, right off Immokalee Road, actually. The day it opened, we planned to have a bike delegation ride from Immokalee, farm workers riding about 30 miles to meet Trader Joe's and greet them as they open their first Florida store. We were going to then follow up on Sunday with an enormous protest where we invited people from all over Florida to come protest the first Trader Joe's. And lastly, for that same weekend that they were opening the store, we were planning 42 actions around the country that allies in solidarity with the CIW were going to be going to their local Trader Joe's and protesting, doing a manager letter drop and other actions outside of the store. So it was with that pressure that the day before they opened their first Trader Joe's store, they signed an agreement with us.
That's just amazing. Elbin, what difference does this signing of the agreement with Trader Joe's, what difference does it make for a worker in the field picking tomatoes?
Es muy importante para nosotros como trabajadores porque un trabajador antes no tenía derecho.
So the significance of Trader Joe's signing an agreement is extremely important in our struggle. Historically, workers have received sub-poverty wages for decades, and there have been no rights in the fields, and workers have had no voice in the workplace. But just beginning now with the campaign for fair food, we call it A New Day, is dawning in the agricultural industry. We now see that workers have respect. We now see that workers have a dignified work, and we now see that many of the basic rights contained in these fair food agreements are actually going into place. And so some of the basic rights in these agreements are health and safety for the workers, freedom from sexual harassment, and other basic rights that may have existed on the books before, but what are rights without enforcement? And so up until this point, while some of these rights may have existed on the books, they were never enforced, and so there was never actually any way for them to be our rights. In addition to Trader Joe's signing and supporting these basic rights, they're also paying the fair food premium, which is the small amount that they pay on top of their tomatoes to lift worker wages. And so workers this season are actually seeing an increase in their paychecks in the form of a bonus that they're receiving from companies like Trader Joe's and the other nine companies that are participating in these fair food agreements.
In light of this victory, I understand that you are now turning your efforts to the chain of Publix supermarkets. Can you explain what the campaign will entail?
Ahora, después de lograr esta victoria, vamos a ir contra Publix. Sí, es cierto, vamos a luchar.
Currently, we're asking Publix to also do the same thing and to sign onto these fair food agreements. And we're asking them to live up to their motto, which is do the right thing, one of the mottos that they were founded on. And we know that they're a company that's based here in Florida. We know that they're an enormous company that buys an enormous quantity of tomatoes in bulk. And we know that they have some responsibility for some of the conditions that we face here. So we're asking them to do the same thing, to participate in these fair food agreements, pay the penny per pound, respect workers' rights, but so far they've refused. Publix has refused to come to the table and sit down with farm workers to dialogue about these historic changes that are happening in the fields, and we don't know why, but we know that they're an extremely important piece to this whole puzzle and that we have to work as hard as we can to bring them on board.
Now, I heard rumor that there is going to be a fast and that you're inviting people from all around the country to participate. Is that part of the Publix campaign?
Sí, es un ayuno por...
What we're calling for is a fast to begin outside of Publix's headquarters, which is located in Lakeland, Florida. And it'll be a fast of about a week, a six-day fast, where workers from Immokalee are inviting allies from around the country, Florida and all over the U.S., to join with them in this fast against Publix. And the idea came out of farm workers in Immokalee having been tired of now 2 years of protests, of marches, of bike delegations all the way to the headquarters, and Publix's staunch refusal to time and time again not even be willing to sit down and dialogue with the CIW. And so we realized that at this point we have no other options, that we've exhausted all means of attempted communication, and that we have the only option we have is to put our bodies on the line, to pay the price with our own bodies, and to demand that Publix cease this harvest of shame and to join with us in these landmark agreements. And Elvin also said that we as workers in Immokalee, we know what it's like to be hungry. It happens all the time. If the boss decides not to pay you for that week, then you go without eating. If there's a freeze or other weather conditions, there's no crops available for harvesting, well, workers won't be able to find work and will go hungry. So as workers, we know what it's like. We're used to this hunger. It's commonplace in our lives and commonplace in the reality for farm workers in Immokalee. We want to bring that into the Publix campaign and show them that we are willing to do this, that their refusal to participate in these agreements will result in more hunger for other workers and that they need to participate in this program.
I think that irony of farm workers who put food on people's tables and fill their bellies, willing to go hungry themselves and often do go hungry themselves because of the way they're treated, won't be lost on people like us. And we want to do everything we can to support you. People want to give support by coming down or by writing in or whatever you need. Is there some way that we can contact you?
Sí, realmente tenemos nuestro sitio que es... Bueno, ahorita lo va a decir el compañero, pero es...
Yes, we do have a webpage that you're welcome to visit, and it's www.ciw-online.org, and you can go to it to learn more about the upcoming fast and our campaign with Publix, and you can follow the fast if you're not able to attend. Of course, you are welcome and invited to come down for any part of the fast. It'll be from March 5th to March 10th here in Lakeland, Florida. And we're inviting anyone to come down for whatever dates they can. But if you're unable to attend, please do follow us on the website. We'll have updates about the fast constantly. And once again, that's www.ciw-online.org. Urban also said that just as we won with Trader Joe's, well, we know that's a victory that doesn't just affect us as farm workers. It affects all of us who eat tomatoes, who benefit from the hard work of other people who work in the fields every day to pick the produce that comes to our tables. We ask that you join with us in our struggle, just as we won with Trader Joe's, and we know that that is a benefit that will affect all of us. We know that when we win with Publix, it'll also be a benefit that benefits the entire society as a whole and not just the individuals who labor here. So we invite you and implore you to come out and join us March 5th to March 10th in Lakeland, Florida, or follow us on the website.
We are so appreciative of your efforts, both of you, Jake and Elbin. Thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jake. Thank you, Elbin. Good luck to you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
the Indians, welcome the pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled the plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed, sent away. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, nobody knows what to say. Save your soul, Lord knows, from winter in America. The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, the struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. It look like either hoping for some rain. And I see the robins perched in barren treetops. They're watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace sign that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. It's winter in a